Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Telling the truth about the past can help us make it right from here on. That belief is what motivates today's guest, sociologist Jim Lowen. In 1995, he intensely read 12 high school U.S. history textbooks for inaccuracies, and he found misinformation that obscured the truth about America's past. The result of that research was his best-selling book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. In 2007, James Lowen updated the book with findings from an additional 6 textbooks. Now, during the era of Donald Trump and alternative facts, he has re-released the book with a new preface calling for better civics education for young people. He writes, quote, "I believe that most Americans, once they understand why things are as they are, will work to foster justice where there was unfairness and truth where lies prevailed." End quote. James Lowen is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Vermont. He's the award-winning author of several books, including Lies Across America, What Our History Sites Get Wrong, and Lies My Teacher Told Me About Christopher Columbus. The latest edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me includes a new preface and has sold nearly 2 million copies. And James Lowen joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning to you on the West Coast.
Well, good morning to you on the East Coast. I'm so glad you're joining us. What a journey this has been. You know, I went to the Big Island last year, and I saw your book on a shelf in a restaurant, which I thought was so great. And I grabbed it and read it because it's one of those books that you can read every couple of years. Let's just talk about this journey. So the first edition came out in 1995, and that was based on your intense reading of 12 high school U.S. history textbooks. Why did you decide to read those books at that time?
Oh, God. First of all, let me say that it was a fate worse than death. They are so boring. I don't think anybody reads them, and I have a reason why I believe that. You might ask me about it a little later on. But the reason I got into this whole thing, I mean, here I am a sociologist. Why am I so interested in U.S. history? Well, it dates from my very first full-time teaching job, which was at a small black college in Mississippi, Tougaloo College, a very good college, but not well-known, let's say, in California. And I was teaching that first year the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology, but I also was pressed into service to teach one section of a course called the Freshman Social Science Seminar. This was a good course. It was invented by the history department. The purpose was to use African-American history, which made sense because 99%+ of our students were African-American, to introduce students to my home discipline of sociology, and you know the drill, psych, econ, poli-sci, anthro. Well, when you're in that special area that is African-American history, the chronology is the same as, shall we say, regular American history. So second semester begins not only after Christmas, it also begins right after the Civil War, with the period known as Reconstruction, of course. And I had a new group of students that first day of class in January. I still remember even what the class looked like, because what happened to me was an aha experience, or it might better be called an oh no experience. What happened to me was I asked them, I didn't want to do all the talking on the first day of class, so I asked them, okay, well, what is Reconstruction? What happened then? And 16 out of my 17 students, all African American, said that was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states, but they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. There are at least, of course, 3 complete lies in that sentence. Black folks never took over the government of the southern states. All of the southern states had white governors throughout the period. All but one had a white majority in the legislature. The Reconstruction governments did not screw up. Without exception, across the South, they passed the best state constitution that the southern states have ever had, far better than the ones they labor under today. And Well, here's a lie. How about the concept too soon out of slavery, as if slavery was an educational institution? Slavery, of course, made it a felony to teach African Americans, even free blacks, to read or write. So anyway, I thought, my gosh, how could this happen? How could you believe? What does it do to you to believe the one time your group was center stage in American history, they screwed up? So I went to nearby schools. And this was just before massive school desegregation in the Deep South. So I went to nearby black schools, and I watched as black teachers taught all black classes this white supremacist, I call it BS history. BS, of course, means bad sociology. And because they were just teaching what was in the book, particularly in the course called Mississippi History, which was required in the fifth grade and then required again in the ninth grade. And that double requirement was, in fact, part of Mississippi's response to the 1954 Supreme Court desegregation decision, Brown v. Board. You know, let's teach the hell out of, quote, our Southern way of life, even if it's total BS, in order to maintain white supremacy. So, what to do? I tried for a year and a half to get historians to write a better textbook for that course, but finally I got a grant, and I put together a team of professors and students at Tougaloo, and also from nearby Millsaps College, the white school, and we wrote a new history of Mississippi, but then the state rejected it for public school use. California has some experience with statewide textbook boards. Every single southern state has a statewide textbook board and adopts statewide. Usually, Mississippi adopts 3 to 5 books in any given subject. In Mississippi history, they only had two. We might call them ours and theirs. And by a 2-5 vote, the 7-member board rejected our book. There were 2 black folks and 5 white folks on that board. I think you can do the math. So we then sued them. And the lawsuit is, in fact, called Lowen et al. Versus Turnipseed et al. And eventually we won. And our book was ordered adopted. But then that just meant it was on the list, and school districts could choose any book they wanted.
Wow. You know, we've done a lot of shows over the years about school books, who makes the decisions, the industry, yeah, how expensive they are. So that was in 1995 when you read 12 high school U.S. history textbooks. Yeah. And then the second edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me came out in 2007, and you read another 6 new books.
I did.
And you write in your new preface that was partly owing to publisher consolidation.
Yes.
But also because reading them is so tedious.
Yes.
What changes?
Let me go on and say, I don't think anybody ever reads them. I make the analogy, the point of a fishing lure is actually not to catch fish. It is to catch the attention of the fisherman, right? Because you're trying to sell it in the store. Now, there is some truth in advertising, that is, the word gets around that a certain lure actually might catch fish, and so a good way to catch fishermen's attention is to catch fish. But not so much with textbooks. That is, textbooks are gaudy. They've got all kinds of color photos. They've got all kinds of little boxes that interrupt the narrative and look fun to read. But when you actually go to read them, they are deadly. The prose is just... There's actually one book that had 3 whole paragraphs about the famous Cross of Gold speech by William Jennings Bryan, and the only 3 words they quoted from the speech were, you could guess it, of course, cross of gold. Instead, they have these 3 deadly paragraphs written in textbook monotone, I call it, about the speech. And, you know, it's impossible to make the speech itself boring. Mm-hmm. You know, you shall not crucify labor upon a cross of gold. You shall not press down on labor's head this crown of, you know, it's just a dynamic speech. So they are very, very boring. But the very interesting thing that happened when I went to read 6 more books in 2007 was this. I discovered that 2 of the books were identical. That is, for page after page in their last chapter, the chapter that dealt with the war in Iraq, the disputed election in Florida between this guy named Bush and this guy named Gore, you might remember that one, etc., the paragraphs are identical, except maybe one of them has very in it, and the other one doesn't have the word very. The photos are identical. The captions are identical. Everything's identical. And yet one of these books was allegedly written by two very famous people. It was by Boorstin, Daniel Boorstin, who won the Pulitzer Prize twice, I think, and was the Librarian of Congress. And it was by Brooks Mather Kelly, chief archivist at Yale. And the other book was written by four guys, four professors, I don't know their gender, at Miami University of Ohio. And the stuff about the recent past was written by a guy named Alan Winkler, whose title is Distinguished Professor of History. And yet they're identical. And so I called them up, okay? And I didn't call up Boorstin because he had just died, but I called up his co-author, Kelly. And Kelly initially said, Boorstin did it, by which he didn't mean Boorstin cheated, Boorstin copied. He meant Boorstin actually wrote it. And I said to him, well, did you know that for page after page, it is identical to this other book, Pathways to the Present? And he said, and I quote, oh, no, that's terrible. And pretty soon he admitted, quote, Prentice Hall hired somebody to write it. I forget the man's name. So he doesn't know who wrote his book. He doesn't know what the qualifications are of the guy who wrote his book. Then I called up the other guy, Winkler. And Winkler implied that he wrote his book. And then I told him what I just said to you, that it was identical. And he said, I swear he said, oh no, that's terrible. Okay? And then pretty soon he admitted he didn't write his either. And then I said to him, well, aside from the fact that you didn't write it, what do you think about it as a work of history? That's an exact quote of what I said. And here's what he replied, quote, I don't know, excuse me, he didn't say I don't know. He said, just a minute, let me get it down from the shelf. Meaning, how would I know? I've never read the thing.
Wow.
So that's the level of quality control that we have. These authors, their names are just rented and stuck on the cover. They did not write the book. They do not know who wrote the book. They don't know the qualifications of the author. And they never even read the book. And when I'm giving a lecture about this at a college, I say, now, if any of you folks in the audience, you undergraduates, are stupid enough to buy your term paper for $9.95 off the web, I hope you have enough brains to read the damn thing before you turn it in. Because these authors didn't even have those brains.
Wow. We're speaking today with James Loewen, author of the best-selling book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. And James, since you talked about teaching mostly black students, you know, you go into detail about how these history books, these lies, really affect young people, especially young people of color. And over the years, you have received so many emails from a number of young people who say, thank you. Thanks to this book, I see the world in a different light. So can you talk about how these lies in these books really affect, let's talk about black students specifically, and then what responses over the years have you received from black students after reading Lies My Teacher Told Me?
Well, I would be happy to do that, but let me say that after I left Tougaloo, where I taught for 7 years, I moved to the University of Vermont. Okay, and so I claim I've taught at the blackest and the whitest schools in America. And I even pioneered my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, in a class that I taught with that name at the University of Vermont, and they loved it too. So this is not a book of black history. It's not a book aimed at specifically at black students. Indeed, if you think about the lie that I told you to begin with, this whole idiotic lie about Reconstruction and Reconstruction in Mississippi, its effect on white students is equally pernicious because it certainly teaches white students, and this was back in 1969-70, it certainly teaches white students that you better not let those black folks become citizens again. You better not let them vote because we know what happened last time. They screwed up. They were too soon out of slavery. Well, maybe they're better now, but they might screw up. So we got to, in other words, it makes white folks racist. And so I'm particularly concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of response from the black community, well, I got a terrific, I guess it was an email. Yeah, it was from a African American in St. Louis who asked me for a group price on it from Simon and from the publisher, because he was going to put it in 40 black barbershops across St. Louis. And I thought that was pretty cool. If you've ever been to I actually go to a black barbershop, never mind why, but it's the closest barbershop. If you've ever been to one, you know they're kind of community centers, and they have lots of reading material. They have net magazines, of course, but they also have... So this is a way for him, he thought, to get the message out to the black community. So that was one black response. But let me tell you about the most fun response of all, which was from California. It was from some student at AOL.com, and I don't know what... That was back when AOL was pretty big, and I don't know where in California he was. But he was a high school student, and I memorized his email because it was my very favorite email I ever got. And it goes like this. Dear Mr. Lowen, I really like your book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. I've been using it to heckle my teacher from the back of the room. I mean, isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on to say, my friends all like it, too. And if I could get a group price on it from the publisher, I could sell it in the corridors of my high school. And so I thought that was cool. So I sent the email off to the publisher, and a day or two later I got back a group price, and I sent it off to him, only to hear back from him for the second and last time. Dear Mr. Lowen, thank you very much for the group price on Lies My Teacher Told Me. However, I have to put my plan on selling it in high school on hold, because tomorrow I'm getting expelled for failing to stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance. Which, first of all, is illegal, and second of all, I think this young man's name was Pete Kaepernick. No, I mean, whatever his name. It wasn't Kaepernick. The Pete, incidentally, that slipped out. That was a synapse. I had a friend named Pete Kaepernick in high school, so that's where that came from.
Wow.
But anyway, wasn't that a great email?
That is.
And I get emails, even more impressive in a way, I get emails from, I've now gotten an email from stockbrokers and investment bankers and mergers and acquisition people, lawyers. I've gotten at least three, I think I've gotten six of these that say, I really like your book. It really has caused me to change my life. I stopped being a stockbroker or whatever, and I'm now back trained to become a high school teacher.
Wow, that is amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Today we're joined by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. If you have any questions or comments for James, if you've read this book and you'd like to talk about the effect it had on you, so many amazing stories in here about, you know, the truth about Christopher Columbus, the truth about the first Thanksgiving, the truth about Helen Keller, the radical socialist. And if you remember what you learned in history class, what really stands out for you, if you have a child in history class, what are they learning right now? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also go online at the KALW Facebook page. We're live there. You can leave a comment, or you can email your call at kalw.org. Okay, James, one more question about stories, and then we'll dive in. In the new preface, you write that history is the least liked subject in American high schools. It is positively abhorred in Indian country. There it is, the record of five centuries of defeat. Yet properly understood, American history is not a record of Native incompetence, but of survival and perseverance. From speaking before Native audiences in six states, I have come to understand to what extent false history holds Native Americans down. So what really stands out for you when you speak before Native audiences about what they're reading in history books?
Well, let me mention that tomorrow I'm actually leaving Washington, D.C., and making my way to Montana, where I'm going to be speaking at the Salish Kootenai Reservation and also at their tribal college on Monday and Tuesday of next week. The regard that Indian country has for Lies My Teacher Told Me continues, and it just really moves me. I'm so happy for that. One of the things that I emphasize is the concept of syncretism. Do you know the word syncretism?
No. In fact, I read that word syncretic in one of the emails that an Indian wrote you, and I had never heard of it before.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad he or she used the term. Yeah, I'm going to teach it to everybody I talk with there. Syncretism is how cultures change, basically. And it means, it's syn, S-Y-N, means putting things together, like synthesis. So syncretism is putting stuff together from two cultures, or even more than two cultures. And it really explains how cultures change. They can change and develop on their own, but they especially do when they come into contact with other cultures, which they're always doing, or almost always doing, at their edges. For example, we can think of Christmas. Now, Christmas has some ideas from the Middle East, like the idea of Jesus Christ and the idea of monotheism. But it's mostly a bunch of ideas from Northern Europe, like the holly and the ivy and the Christmas tree, the emphasis on light, the Yule log, because, of course, it all has to do with the December shortest day of the year, which is what it's marking. So it takes those two ideas, those two sets of ideas, and puts them together, and you got Christmas. Or you can think of almost all the great cuisines of the world. I mean, like Italian. I don't know what the heck Italians were eating in 1491, but it certainly wasn't pasta with tomato sauce, because they didn't have no tomatoes, because that's from the Americas, right? I don't know what the folks were eating in, let's say, Sichuan province in China, but it certainly wasn't the spices that Sichuan food is famous for now, because all of those spices came from the Americas. So foods all around the world, recipes, I don't mean the original food, the corn, but everything you do with it, that's a matter of syncretism. Well, native people especially need to understand that, because they, for a century now, at least since 1890, they have felt trapped. They cannot figure out how to be native in America, or how to be, shall we say, white, you know? And they see this as a terrible choice, and they don't know what to do. And this leads to all kinds of problems, alcoholism and drug abuse and so on, suicide. And the answer is right there in syncretism. That is, they've got to put it together. And many of them do all the time. I mean, there's ways of healing, for example, that make use of native spirituality and modern antibiotics at the same time. The same thing is true for let's say Buffy St. Marie, okay, the famous singer. She's making use of American, Western, European instruments, and all kinds of ideas and tonalities, even from native music. So that's why syncretism is so, it's really so important to everybody, but it's especially important in Indian country.
And before we go to break, you wrote an entire book about Columbus, Lies My Teacher Told Me About Christopher Columbus. Yeah. And I mean, it is shocking what you see in history books, but not even books. I was just at the Library of Congress in Washington, and there's this exhibit.
I go there.
Yeah, there's an exhibit called Exploring the Early Americas.
Yeah.
I mean, the text is so outdated.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so simplistic, and it was actually shocking. And I said something to the volunteer, and she agreed and said, oh, this really needs to be updated.
And you know, that's actually a pretty new exhibit.
Really?
How about that?
Well, it's
yeah,
pretty
it's
bad.
It went up in three years ago.
Wow.
It is very interesting. If you think about the terminology. Now, I try to sum up Columbus with the simple word exploit. And that's because he did a remarkable exploit. You know, he did sail west, and he did persevere, and especially in his second voyage, when he actually takes over the entire island of Haiti, renames it Hispaniola, or Little Spain, comes back, you know, with 17 ships and with attack dogs and with armored horses and with cannons, and the 3 million approximately native people on Haiti have no chance, especially there's also the amazing disease vectors involved, and the deculturation, because he forces them to stop making their native foods and make Spanish foods and stop making food, period, and mine for gold and so on. Well, anyway, that's a heck of an exploit. And he also proceeds to exploit everybody he comes into contact with. And so, you know, that word can kind of sum up both the positives and the negatives of Columbus, so that we get a little more complex view of the guy. And you know what? This is the one area that the textbooks are now doing a little bit better in. If you look at how they're doing on the Vietnam War, though, for example, they're doing even worse.
Even worse. Wow. Well, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with James Loewen, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Vermont. He is the author of many best-selling books, including Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. He's out with a new edition with a new preface. And Howard Zinn says, every teacher, every student of history, every citizen should read this book. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by James Loewen, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Vermont. He is the award-winning author of many bestsellers, including Lies Across America, What Our History Sites Get Wrong, Lies My Teacher Told Me About Christopher Columbus, and Lies My Teacher Told Me. It sold nearly 2 million copies, and he's out with a new edition with a new preface. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about some of the lies that you were told in school, if you've read James' book and it opened your eyes to a particular topic, whether it's about Helen Keller, who was an incredible radical socialist, the true story of Christopher Columbus, the true story of the first Thanksgiving, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Before the break, James, you were saying that history books are doing a better job of telling the truth about Columbus. And of course, indigenous activists have been doing amazing work around this issue. And now there are so many cities that celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day, and in some states, including yours in Vermont.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's mine. I've been living in Washington, D.C. for more than 20 years now, and the guy in charge of the government in Washington, not the city government, I'm talking about the overall government, this guy named Trump, I think it is, I'm not sure that he's in favor of Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah, I don't know. With the photo of Andrew Jackson in his office, or the portrait of Andrew Jackson, I'm not sure.
Kind of the opposite side of some of these matters. Well, I think that actually the state of South Dakota, 20 years ago, maybe more, pioneered this because they named it statewide Indigenous Peoples Day or Native Peoples Day, something like that. And I think the rest of us have been playing catch-up ever since. Mm. It's interesting that Columbus Day has a whole history. It didn't really become a day until after World War II, although it became, it depends on where you were in the country. And it was especially pushed by Italian Americans. Now, that's fine. I mean, everybody can have their own thing, you know, their own day, if you will. We have St. Patrick's Day, so why not Columbus Day? Except there's a couple problems with this. One of them is we don't even know for sure that Columbus was Italian. That's quite contested. It's quite possible that he was Spanish Jew, and that his parents, or maybe grandparents, but probably parents, left Spain because Spain was beginning to go anti-Semitic before 1492. And in fact, in 1492, it specifically went anti-Semitic and threw out all its Jews unless they converted to Catholicism right there. Well, it's interesting. Columbus never wrote in Italian. I'm not even sure if he spoke in Italian, but he certainly never wrote it. He wrote in Spanish. And there's some other reasons to think that he may not be Italian at all. We maybe have to leave that open for more research. I'm not sure.
Hmm.
But we can maybe let Columbus Day go. And if and do you guys know, do you know that you have a big statue of Columbus? It's the biggest thing in your state capitol. Did you know that?
You know, I did not know that. I knew that we had a statue in there. I didn't know it was so big.
Well, it's really big, and it shows Queen Isabella, and Columbus is down there kind of on bended knee, and he's holding up a sphere, and he's showing her that the world is round. Now, this is another problem. I mean, everybody in the world understood that the world was round. Sailors literally see the roundness of the world. When a ship sets off, even when it sets off across a big lake like, say, Lake Michigan, because the instead of becoming littler and littler and littler until it's a dot and then disappearing, which is what would happen if it was flat, you can't see the hull because the roundness of the earth gets in the way. And then you can't see the sails. And finally, at the end, you can't see the little flag on top. Well, everybody understood that. You know, even growing up in the Midwest, where we don't got no ocean, 18-wheelers disappeared the same way over the horizon in the Middle West prairies that I grew up in, you know. Native people knew it was round. They called it Turtle Mountain, you know, because the shell of a turtle is, of course, round. So this whole mythology that he was a man of science proving the world round is, you know who made it up? The same guy made it up who made up the Tales of Ichabod Crane, namely Washington Irving, the novelist. He wrote a three-volume biography, a huge biography of Christopher Columbus, in about 1812, I think, I'm not sure, maybe a little later. And that book, or those three books, stayed in print for the rest of the century, and that's where the round world story came from.
And James, speaking of statues, you know, as someone who studies history, writes about history, tries to expose the truth, what do you think about the statues that are coming down? I mean, just last night in San Francisco, a Board of Appeals voted unanimously to remove the, quote, early days statue here in San Francisco, which shows a Native American at the feet of a Spanish cowboy and a Catholic missionary. A number of Native Americans, you know, were in San Francisco last night testifying about why they want this statue to be taken down.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I argue against that statue in my book, Lies Across America. And in Lies Across America, I have a appendix which lists 20 candidates for toppling. So not only am I in favor of taking down these terrible statues, I think I am the first person to come out for it. Why is it important to take it down? I think we need to make the argument, and we need to make it in a very sober way. Is it kind of like what the Taliban did? Is it kind of like destroying history? Not at all. What we do when we, now this statue, I call it the Pioneer Statue, but what did you say the name of it was?
It's called Early Days. It's in big letters on the bottom.
Yeah. It shows a white man, as I remember it, it shows a white man in kind of a threatening position standing up, a Native American on his back, kind of about to be dispatched, possibly, certainly down at the bottom of the statue. And I think then there's somebody halfway in the middle, another white person maybe on his knees, kind of worshiping maybe.
Well, there's a Spanish cowboy standing, a Catholic missionary standing, and the Native American is on his kind of down,
on
being
his back
sort
almost.
Of pushed down almost.
Yeah, he's looking up.
Right.
And incidentally, there's a whole bunch of these. There's one of these kind of like that in St. Cloud, Minnesota, right in front of the Catholic hospital. We got statues from coast to coast that show Indians in the bottom position and white folks in the top position. There's even a term for this stuff. It's called hieratic art. Hier as in H-I-E-R, kind of like hierarchy. Mm. I had to learn that term, hieratic art, from my book, Lies, my teacher told me. Now, the problem with these things, San Francisco had earlier done an interesting thing. Namely, they had put up a big plaque right next to this statue. And the plaque basically tells a bunch of American Indian history. It was probably written by Native people, and it was certainly approved by Native people, and it basically says, hey, you know, we're still here. We took a big hit, especially around 1850 during the Gold Rush days when our numbers were cut down by 90%, but we're still here in California, and here's some of our history. So that's good, and I suspect that plaque will stay up. But I think what San Francisco finally decided was the message of the symbolism itself is so strong that to leave it in a place of honor, and of course it was in a place of honor. It's right in front of the city library, and it's right in front of the of City Hall,
right,
in this big square. Well, what I hope they do, and what I suspect they will do, is put it in a big museum, maybe even in the California History Museum that's across the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you can talk about it. You can say, well, this shows how the thinking of, I don't know, 1912 or whenever the heck the thing went up. And with regard to Confederate statues, I was just dealing with one of those this morning. They are, of course, under duress all across the country. And they're coming down, most of them. I think eventually most of them, not yet most yet, but a bunch of them have already come down. They too will end up in museums where they become study objects of the era that they went up. And this is another term then, like syncretism, the second term I want to teach to every Native American, and in fact to every American, is the word historiography. And that word, as you may know, means the study of history. But not in the sense of, oh gosh, I'm way behind, I got to do historiography this weekend. No, the study of the writing of history. Who wrote this history textbook? We already talked about that. Who didn't write it? You know, who put up this statue? When did it go up? And we find that almost every single one of the Confederate statues goes up between 1890 and 1940. So once you understand historiography, then you realize that every historic site, and for that matter, every historic source, whether it's a history movie or a textbook or a book or a painting or monument, every historic site is a tale of two eras. It's a tale of what it's about, to be sure, but it's also a tale of when it went up. And these Confederate monuments all went up between 1890 and 1940, and that period has a name. And it's called the Nadir, or Nadir, N-A-D-I-R, it's an English language word, means low point, the Nadir of race relations. And during those 50 years, from 1890 to 1940, we, and I speak as a white American, but we, the country, went more racist in our thinking than at any other point in our national or even pre-national lives. I'm not saying it was worse to be black in say 1895 than it was in 1855 and be enslaved, not at all. But I am saying that in terms of white racism, it peaked between 1890 and 1940, and we see that in many ways. One of them is that lynchings go to their all-time high. All kinds of things happen in the North that had not happened before. For instance, black folks get thrown out of the dormitories in a bunch of shall we say, white schools such as Harvard, and I suspect even things like, you know, some branches of the University of California, certainly University of Minnesota, threw black students out of the dorms during the nadir of race relations. They had been in the dorms. Then they can go to school, but they have to live with some black family. They can't live on campus. Well, this kind of thing happened all across America, and in particular, it led to the phenomenon that I've also written a book about, and that's sundown towns. That book just came out, too, in a new edition this summer. Sundown towns are, of course, towns that are all white on purpose, and they, almost all of them, get formed between 1890 and 1940. So this is a terribly important era, this nadir of race relations, and yet almost nobody knows the term, and almost no history textbook includes it.
James Loewen is the author of the best-selling Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. It's out with a new preface. It's a best-selling book, nearly 2 million copies sold. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What did you learn in history class? If you have kids in school, what are they learning? And where are you getting information like this? I mean, if you read this book, what really stood out for you? Let's hear from Elaine in Oakland. Hi, Elaine. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I do have a question, but I also want to say that in 1968, I was an incoming freshman at that small college in Mississippi, Tougaloo College, and I was also enrolled in that social science seminar that Dr. Loewen taught. Actually, we called him Jim.
Wow.
We were always on first-name basis with our teachers at Tougaloo.
You were my student?
I was, Jim.
I'm excited.
My name was Elaine Anderson at the time, and of course I knew you, and I knew Pat, and I knew Nicholas, and you know, it was a small world that we
had. Yeah, well, we better not do this on air, but I'm delighted to hear from you.
It's fine. Thank you.
But my question is also, one comment and one question. One is that I totally agree that the Mississippi history that we taught was false, and it was a relic. It was a part of the racism of that time. But I want to also acknowledge that some of our teachers taught that history with a kind of tongue-in-cheek, grin-and-bear-it approach. They knew that some of it was lies, but of course they were forced to teach it as part of their roles and responsibilities, and that probably came out in your research. But I also think that When I think about today, fast forward to today, when we live in this world of talking about alternative facts, which, of course, is just a euphemism for a lie, mm-hmm. what do you think will be the impact in the future of our students today? I was a sociology major, or English major with an interest in sociology while at Tougaloo. But we were excited about the humanities when I was a freshman or a college student, you know, many years ago. We thought the humanities actually gave us a deeper understanding of the world in
yes.
which we lived. But now yes. there's this demise and decline in the interest in the humanities. What do you think will be the impact of that in the next 20, 30, 40 years when students won't be able to look back, but maybe won't have the tools to look back and critique this current era in which we're living? So I'll take my answer offline.
Sure. Well, that's very interesting. Let me say this. In the brand new edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me, I have a new preface that is called something like Lies My Teacher Told Me in the Age of Alternative Truths or something like that. The alternative facts, excuse me. And of course, that term alternative fact is famously invented by Kellyanne Conway of the Trump administration, and she did it on the first day of the Trump administration, I believe. And the very first picture in the book now, in this new edition, is dual pictures of Obama's inauguration, a photo of the crowd, and next to it, Trump's inauguration, a photo of the crowd. And, of course, the alternative fact is, given by Kellyanne and by Sean Spicer, the press secretary, is that Trump's inaugural crowd was the biggest ever. And you can literally see the spaces, the blank pavement and ground where there's nobody standing for Trump's inauguration, and just the opposite for Obama's, where everything is completely covered by people. Well, I'm actually have popularized this phrase. Everybody's entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. It turns out the phrase has a history that goes back quite a ways. But it's true, and so you have to use facts that are agreed upon. And what the textbooks, our current textbooks, do not do, they do not give students or help students develop tools of critical reading and critical thinking so that they can conclude statement A comes from the following kind of authority, it's in line with the other kinds of statements, it seems to be footnoted, it seems to be all right, where statement B doesn't have those attributes. You don't learn that. Instead, you are just told, here's a list of facts you're supposed to memorize, and this is what learning history is all about.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling. And Elaine, it's amazing that you were James' student. Thank you for calling and sharing your story. And just quickly, James, to add to Elaine's question, we did a show, I believe it was last month.
Wait a minute. I am Jim. Let's go to Jim.
Jim, okay. Jim, thank you. We did a show last month about how students are spending less and less time in social studies class learning about government and
yes.
civics.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that? What can we do to turn that around?
Well, the first problem is the only thing worse than having a, quote, standardized test, unquote, in a field is not to have a test in a field, okay? We had this idea, no child left behind. That was in the Bush administration, George W. Bush. Then we have the new idea, the Common Core. Common Core doesn't really come from the Obama administration. It actually comes out of Bill Gates and some foundations, and it was adopted by a bunch of states, and so it's not really a national program, although some people on the right think that it is a national program to bother our minds. And both of these did not mandate multiple choice so-called standardized tests. And in fact, George W. Bush was sad when he learned that that's what he had really gotten us into. He didn't have that intention. And the Common Core is now being distorted by some of the big textbook test publishers, like Prentice Hall and the company that owns it. The result is that you get these stupid multiple choice tests. And the result further is that schools, teachers, and entire school districts get rated on how they do. And if you're not doing good, getting good scores in math, science and English, well, then you can get screwed. And so people are going to take time away from, as you noted, social studies or history, because they have to focus on getting their math scores up, getting their English scores up. Well, I think math and English are very important, but you can actually teach a lot of math and especially a lot of English when you are teaching social studies and when you are teaching history, especially if you're not teaching shallow, what I call twig history. We're not teaching the forest or the trees. We're teaching these isolated twigs, you know, like Columbus came over in 1491, 1492, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that we do need to give time to social studies in U.S. history, but only, and I repeat, only if people are going to teach the subject using the textbook as a tool, but also attacking the textbook when appropriate, using other sources. There's no need anymore for these 1,200-page textbooks. We've got the web. We've got all kinds of alternative sources, not alternative facts. Some of them are facts. And so we got to get students learning how to use all the sources at their disposal and when to believe them and when not by critiquing them.
We don't have time to take Julie in Asheville, North Carolina, but she wanted to let you know that she did her thesis comparing fourth grade history textbooks 20 years apart, and nothing changed from the 60s to the 80s.
Yeah. Well, she should try it in the 2020s, excuse me, and she'll get further depressed. My book has not caused much change in the textbooks. What it has caused a bunch of teachers, I'm saying maybe moving towards 50% of the teachers, to teach against the textbook, to get students thinking, to do more than just memorize these stupid twigs.
Well, James, I feel like we had a mini history lesson with you today, and I'm so glad that you were able to join us. Thank you so much for all the work that you've done, and we'd love to have you back.
All right. Well, it's been fun, and carry on.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
James Loewen is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Vermont. He is the author of many bestsellers. In fact, I need to get some of these books, because many of the things he mentioned, I realized I did not learn about that, and I don't know much about that. Lies Across America, What Our History Sites Get Wrong, Lies My Teacher Told Me About Christopher Columbus, and his latest edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. It's got a new preface. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.